And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I'm Phil Taylor, and we'll probably be joined a little bit by Phil Conlon. So the today's lineup is going to be, should be rather interesting. Eve Engler has written a new book and is an important commentary on all things to do with peace, war, and avoidance, particularly of war. And he's written a book about Lester Pearson. You might call it a sober reevaluation. He says the truth may hurt. And so we're going to be talking to Eve about the new book. He's coming here in March to launch the book. And at about the halfway point, we will be talking to Stephen Gowans. You know him, gowans.wordpress.com. And he has a good title for his column called, to his regular commentary, What's Left? And that's always a good question when you see things like what just occurred at the United Nations and you hear the comments of the leadership here. And I want to make sure we announce some news. An important Chilean student leader is in town tomorrow, the 10th. His name is Camilo Ballesteros. And, you know, the Chilean student movement is, I'm going to use a word to tell us not to use anymore, awesome. Hundreds of thousands of people. And he's going to be talking. And his slogan is, education is a right, not a privilege. And he's going to be talking to on the 10th at the Nat Taylor Cinema, York University, at 1 o'clock. And we hope that everybody's going to, who can, will make that talk. And we're joined now by, I believe, by Eve Engler. How are you doing there, Eve?
How's it going, Phil?
Very good. Now, you listen, you're coming to Toronto in March, and you're going to be launching a book. Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, colon, The Truth May Hurt. And you have an interesting approach to this. It's under the rubric of truth and reconciliation. Maybe you'd like to present this to the Canadian public and have everybody come to terms with who this gentleman was, right?
Yeah, well, not just who Pearson was, but also more importantly, what you know, the I guess one could say the real history of Canadian foreign policy, not the one that's presented to us by most political institutions and most political commentators, but I think the a history of Canadian foreign policy that is one that would embarrass most Canadians, and to and Pearson being the symbol of the supposed peacekeeping benevolent foreign policy that that is not not based in fact.
I think you really get to a key thing here. One is the continuity of Canadian leadership and foreign policy with the little bumps and difficulties that have been encountered as post-World War II. And there's a tendency, you identify, you say, there, in terms of approaching the reputation of Lester Pearson, that people think of him as the golden age, that he was resisting the aggressive tendencies of the U.S. and perhaps Britain, that he was sort of the sober realist trying to rein them in. But that's a false picture.
It's a completely false picture. I think that Lester Pearson was a very much a believer in U.S. empire, a believer in Western power and domination of, over the world, and his role in you know, the creation of NATO 48, 49, even a little bit earlier, he really saw NATO as an entity to exert Western U.S.-led dominance around the world, and in the context of a decolonization that was taking place in much of Asia and in a little bit later on throughout Africa. And I think that Pearson saw, in part at least, NATO as a way to maintain an alliance of the former colonial powers with under U.S. Heading to combat or to weaken the decolonization movement taking place around the world. And if you look at the role he played in the Korean War and how he basically almost threatened to resign as the external affairs minister if Canada didn't send ground troops to Korea, and that's a war that led to three or so million people being killed. In the book, we go into, people like Linda McQuaig, who is, seen as a left-wing, probably one of the most left-wing columnists in mainstream Canadian
probably is
media, yeah. And how she consciously misrepresents Pearson's role in a whole series of different things, most notably his role in the Vietnam War. But his motivation for establishing NATO and others, and it's because he's a symbol of supposedly trying to weaken American belligerence, American militarism, when I think the historic record's pretty clear that he was a strong defender of U.S. empire.
Yeah, this is Eve Egler, and we're talking about the new book, it's going to be launched here in Toronto in March. It's titled Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt. And by the way, it's very readable. It is terrific. You've done a lot of work on this book, Eve. You weren't just going through newspapers. You have gone through diaries and everything else. The picture I get is this is – people don't understand. This was a heavyweight backroom guy who was well-connected from day one. I mean, he was really – he was a trusted man. And matter of fact, just to illustrate, could you mention – there's a story how he and Kennedy wanted to help each other out, and he didn't want to be embarrassed. So Kennedy did him a favor so that the two of them could plot together.
Yeah, Kennedy actually asked him about if he could get honorary degree from different universities in the Boston area. And Pearson already had an honorary degree from Harvard and MIT, so Kennedy got him got the University of Boston Boston University to offer him an honorary degree to have a justification for heading down to Boston so he could spend the weekend with Kennedy, plotting how. How they were going to shape world affairs.
Yeah, and incidentally, you point out there is this issue, and I think it's a kind of a reflex problem that journalists have. In order to make the point today, they like to reach into history and say, well, if Trudeau were here or if Pearson were here, and with Diefenbaker, people don't understand that you point out in your book that Diefenbaker and King actually were more suspicious of U.S. power. It actually got, and in the case of Diefenbaker, got roughed up by U.S. power because of failure to stay in step.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's clear that...
And I'm not saying they're my favorites.
No, I get a little hesitant on that. But no, it's clear the Kennedy administration helped Pearson defeat the Diefenbaker government in 63, bring down Diefenbaker. And that's the different officials from the Kennedy administration have said that pretty openly after the fact. And there was a little bit more, I think, reticence from Diefenbaker in terms of some elements of U.S. Policy, in particular, obviously, in relationship to the Cuban Missile Crisis. But I think that the more important point when it comes to commentators, particularly those who are critical of the Harper government or current day foreign policy decisions, that there is this tendency to just say, hey, if we could just return back to the good old days, Mm-hmm. And what's really you know, troubling about that, I think, part of why that's sort of it's more acceptable in mainstream newspapers or think tanks or the NDP or wherever it may be, is that implicit in that is that there isn't a fundamental problem with Canadian foreign policy. And I see that there's actually a fundamental problem with Canadian foreign policy, and that's that foreign policy is overwhelmingly determined by a foreign policy establishment that is dominated by, you know, military companies, by the 1% economic elite, by a small handful of sort of academics and think tanks, and that it's the realm of decision making that's least democratic within our society, where the majority of the population have the least amount of influence, and obviously much of domestic policy, the opinions of the majority is often left out of the equation. But it's that much more so when it comes to foreign policy, and that Canadian foreign policy has been fundamentally since the get go about elite perspective and about advancing that elite perspective's interests around the world. Mm-hmm. And so to say, if we just move from Harper to the good old days, you're implicitly downplaying the structural problem. Mm-hmm. When it comes to foreign policy.
Well, again, this is Eve Engler, and you make the point, and it's full of wonderful quotes. I mean, the book, it says that Pearson, when evaluating himself, said NATO was my most successful job, putting it together, making it a success. And I prevented a war somewhere. It was building NATO.
Yeah, no, most Canadians would think of Pearson, they think of Nobel Peace Prize, they think of peacekeeping, maybe the Suez Crisis, and that's sort of why he won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1957 for helping to sort of deal with the Suez Crisis of 56. But if you look at what happened in Suez, it makes complete sense why Pearson would cite NATO as the most important thing he was involved with, and not peacekeeping, because the point of the Canadian backed or the Pearson backed UN mission in Egypt in 56 was the French and the British, as well as the Israelis, invaded Egypt, and that was not the Washington was not happy with that invasion. So what Pearson was doing was basically siding with the Americans and trying to get the French and the British out of Egypt and off the hook for a disastrous invasion. And really, what was the intent? The intent there was to smooth over differences within NATO, differences between the French and British on one hand and the Americans over the invasion of, mm-hmm. of Egypt. So the intent of peacekeeping in 56, from Pearson's perspective, was really to save NATO from internal division. So it makes complete sense that he would cite NATO as the thing he considered most important in establishing, because the thing that he's most famous for, peacekeeping, was actually really largely about NATO. And then also on the other hand, if you look at NATO was, and there's Pearson is quite open about this in the Hansard discussions in the parliamentary debates, where he saw NATO as a defensive arrangement for the Middle East, for Asia. So I use the term defensive somewhat ironically, right? It was obviously an offensive way of Western powers maintaining their control, their dominance over much of the world. That was what NATO was for mm-hmm. Lester Pearson.
Yeah, and you mentioned that, and this, by the way, raises the issue of even the word criminality. And let's tell a story from this book begins with a very nice preface by Noam Chomsky, and it is not a throwaway preface. He says that when he's always been pretty welcome in Canada because he badmouths U.S. foreign policy. So he said one day, just to kind of change the tempo a bit, he was on Peter Zowski's show, and he said, well, of course, you have a former prime minister who was a war criminal, and he's talking about Lester Pearson. He said Zalewski became really hostile. I mean, loud hostile. And now that's a heck of a story. That's amazing. And he said he couldn't believe that how upset they were and disbelieving. But there's you provided quite a bit of evidence if one wanted to make a case. This is a power broker who was helping out in a lot of places, in, for example, Vietnam. Isn't it so that he that is you document in the book that intelligence was being passed by so-called UN observers, Canada, to the United States? It was direct.
Yeah, beyond just intelligence, there was significant intelligence passed, and that was
when they were bombing
Haiphong, North Vietnam.
North Vietnam. Pardon me.
And it was not just a matter of intelligence being passed, and it wasn't just a matter of low level official Canadian officials sort of supporting the Americans. This went back to meetings that that Lyndon Johnson had with Pearson, and Pearson gave the very explicit okay, which came out in the Pentagon Papers about how Canadian officials on the International Control Commission for Vietnam, which was supposed to be bringing peace to the area helping to unify the country, that in fact they were doing in part was delivering U.S. bombing threats to the north. So basically, Canadian officials with Pearson's okay were going from going down to Washington, getting briefed by Americans to what to say to the North Vietnamese officials and say, if you don't do this, we're going to bomb you.
Yes,
threatening them.
Passing on threats
and of something that led to, I don't know the exact number, but tens, probably into hundreds of thousands of people who were, I think normally often people talk about 100,000 people who were killed in these bombing raids by the Americans in North Vietnam. So there was a level of complicity. And in the Vietnam War, I mean, the complicity was a whole series of different levels, from weapon sales to repeated public comments by Lester Pearson supporting the U.S. Military effort in Vietnam. And what is absolutely incredible about all this is that he is often portrayed by progressive people, like in the case of Linda McQuaig in her book, Living the Bully's Coat. He's portrayed
as people all remember the anecdote about how Pearson went down to see Johnson and he picked him up by his ears and showed him to the reporters or something. And you contextualize that, and they didn't have a falling out. They had maybe an argument with each other, but it was just all they did was reorganize themselves.
It was exactly that. It was the extent to which Johnson was angry at Pearson was that, from Johnson's perspective, Pearson was his guy. Pearson had been helping out with the war in Vietnam. He had been even helping out with the bombing of North Vietnam. And then there was a debate going on within the U.S. administration about the question of continuing the bombing of North Vietnam and holding off for a bit and different sort of strategic discussions. And basically, Pearson had sided with another faction within the U.S. administration over that question. And Johnson was not happy about that.
And he preempted the announcement, right? This was something they were thinking about doing, and by making the announcement, they kind of knocked off their timing.
Exactly. And so sort of disagreement around the edges of U.S. policy in Vietnam, that has been blown up by innumerable commentators to say that Pearson opposed the war in Vietnam. Now, you can go to the Hansard debates, and you can read, as I did, between 1963 and 1968, when Pearson was prime minister, and much of that time the war in Vietnam was raging, and you can read example after example of Pearson making it absolutely, unequivocally clear that he supported the U.S. war in Vietnam. And so somehow that historical record, which is very easy to access at any academic library that anyone would want to go to, has been just wiped off. And instead, we're left with things where people actually say, like in the case of Linda McQuaig's book, where she actually says that Pearson's urgings, in the case of the Johnson in 65 and the later example, that this helped lead to the end of the war in Vietnam. And this is, I mean, I'm being a little hard on Linda McQuigg in the book and in this discussion, because it's not just her. She's just one example. But this is throughout the sort of liberal...
There is a glow around the guy. There's no question. There's a little a little warm glow. Because a part of you point out he had a real knack for conning people.
He was a skilled operative. There's no doubt that he was good at pursuing a certain policy and then putting a very nice moral gloss over that policy in a different context. So he would at one point he when there was questions about nuclear weapons coming to Canada, he would say, you know, the real question is not the weapon. It's ending war as a means of statecraft.
Hey, by the way, that's a very. I want to underline that you really have a great chapter about he rode the atom bomb to political power here. He was the one who escorted the bombs in here.
Yes,
and they were very grateful to that for that.
Yes.
and signed off on authority. They had the command structure, the NORAD, so that they could call their counterpart here and tell them to load up and do something without bothering to wake the prime minister.
Exactly, and so
you probably wouldn't want to be waked anyway for that. Rather read about it in the paper.
Yeah, some small affair like that. But I think also part of it is you know Pearson was very you know skilled at sucking up the power. I mean, I think that's the in the conclusion chapter. That's really the focus. Is that this? You know, it's not that this guy was just some evil, you know, whatever.
He believed in what he was doing.
Yeah, he believed in what he was doing. But I think part of it was that he was a guy who was he was ambitious and you know came from a certain type of background and wanted to move up in the world, and the way you do that is to suck up to
Rockefellers.
People.
He was very the Rockefellers gave him their home to go for vacation.
Exactly.
Not
people
bad.
Like that.
They haven't done that for me. I know. I keep checking my mail.
It's coming soon, though. I think that it went to the trash box. You just missed that email.
This is Eve Engler, I got to say. By the way, Eve, you and I have spoken in the past about these things. I'm sure glad you're going to be coming here to launch your book. But I'm thinking years ago, and I don't even know the content of it, but James F. Menifee used to work for CBC. He wrote a book with a great title. And as far as I was concerned, all he needed was the title. It was Canada, Peacemaker or Powder Monkey. And guess which he thought? You've nailed it down. I mean, I don't know what the content of that book was, but your content could go in that book. It's terrific and persuasive writing. Let me just say, at the end of the day, what's been going on at the United Nations and the R2P, which I think stands for Right to Pee on You, he would be quite comfortable with it, wouldn't he?
Yeah, I think that Pearson had he was inclined towards very moralistically sounding imperial policy or cover, and I think that's what the responsibility to protect is it's way for the more sort of liberal sectors of the elite to justify the package, if you like. The same kind of pro-intervention, pro-imperial policy. And, of course, we saw that used to justify Canada's 2004 invasion / overthrow of the elected government in Haiti. The consequences of that policy, continue on.
And you point out in the book that he was he didn't mind U.S. unilateralism. He supported their invasion of the Dominican Republic and the Guatemala, the overthrowing the government of Guatemala. He had no problem with that.
Yeah. So he would go along with and he would support the unilateral, but he would prefer to have that sort of type of packaging that we see maybe with what happened in Libya, where you it's all sort of done under the guise of great sort of moral...
Protecting state. Civilians. That's all you do. If you have to kill every last supporter of Gaddafi to do it, that's okay.
Exactly. So I think that, that's... basically in the Canadian foreign policy, in the official Canadian foreign policy discussion, the parameters of the debate are basically the Stephen Harper neocon, let's just do it, we represent the the Western moral light, and the other sort of more liberal responsibility to protect. Okay, we're going to do basically the same thing, but we're going to cover it with a bit more sort of type of gloss, and a little more
Latin,
and so I think that what those of us who believe in internationalism, who believe that there's a common humanity and that there is not they don't want the world structured in the same way it's been structured in terms of Western European North American dominance for a couple hundred years. Our job to break out from that parameter debate and to propose alternative visions of what a Canadian foreign policy could be and to be to be very hardline critical in terms of that history and in terms of who really runs Canadian foreign policy today and whose interests it's serving And the truth is that the world could do with less Canada. That's the reality of the last 70 years or longer of Canadian foreign policy. There is little evidence to suggest Canadian troops are sent abroad for benevolent purposes. There's a lot more evidence to suggest they're sent abroad for imperial and corporate to defend corporate interests than they are sent abroad to do what they're told. We're told they're sent abroad to do, which is help children and whatever.
Yes, or they, just like when they started off in the 19th century, they're still at it. Eva, it's a great book. We're really glad you could talk to us. So we look forward to talking to you probably again, maybe before your arrival. We want to give everybody all the details when you come. But it's Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping: The Truth May Hurt. Thanks an awful lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, talk to you. That's. Eve Engler, and he's already written a number of books. They're always timely. They're always hard, but they say hard-hitting. It's got a nice the preface by Noam Chomsky is it's a great story. He tells about his meeting with Peter Zalski. By the way, that run-in between he has it, not only does he tell you like a little anecdote, but he also understands don't tell somebody a little soundbite joke, and then because the next question is well then what did he say. Actually, apparently it led to quite an argument at the CBC about the Zalski's losing it with him. And they all said, no, you could disagree, but you're not supposed to. But I think that he just when he found out that Chomsky wasn't just going to talk about the U.S., then he sort of went all Yankee on him. And... I think we're joined now by Pat Panman McNeely. Are you there, Pat?
Yeah, I'm right here, Phil.
Hey, thanks an awful lot. You got to tell us, there's a meeting to celebrate and recognize the achievements of Al Hamilton. It's going to be at the Train Studios Tuesday, 8 p.m.
That's tomorrow evening.
At 964 Bathurst, right?
That's correct, tomorrow evening.
But tell me about him. When you think of Al Hamilton, why is it important? What's the number one thing that comes to mind you have to tell people?
Well, this is Black History Month, and Al Hamilton, in the late 60s, started a newspaper that gave an opportunity to black journalists to springboard into the mainstream media. As a matter of fact, he even that sometimes used to have to take some of his editors to the Toronto Star and say, why don't you hire these guys? Look how good they are,
And I liked them better when they were working for him, personally.
Yeah, but he was more interested in... There was nowhere... At that time, Toronto media was all white.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nowhere for these young people to go. And a whole slew of people came out of contrast, which he started a weekly newspaper in 69 until about 4 or 5 years ago when he passed away. A whole slew of people like Jojo Chinto and Royston James and Tom Godfrey, and they were all editors at the conference in the early days and springboarded into mainstream media today.
And so, yeah, Cher, by the way, you think Al Hamilton and you think Cher. He also, I had a message, I know that Otis Richmond was talking about him. He is the, he organized the Jerome Award, right?
Well, the Al Hamilton, and you mentioned Cher. Arnold Ogies was a former editor with Contrast. Yes, Al Hamilton was one of the founding members of the Harry Jerome Award and the Black Businessmen Professional Association, the BBPA. You don't hear his name mentioned, and we're hoping out of tomorrow's event that we'd be able to give a scholarship annually, perhaps in the Harry Jerome facilities, you know. In Contrast's honor and in Al Hamilton's honor. And that's what we're meeting tomorrow about.
Yeah. So it's going to be 8 o'clock at the Train Studios.
That's correct.
There'll be speeches, music.
That's correct. We'll have Royston James will be the host, MC type of thing. And there'll be speeches. Judo Cento will be there and other journalists and so on who are associated with.
It's a great event. I'm really glad you're doing it. Pan Man, we thank you very much.
Okay, it's a part of Toronto history that we must remember.
And Black History Month. Right. Okay.
Bye-bye.
You take it easy. Bye-bye. And that's Pat McNeely, Pan Man. And he's quite right. There's too little known about this. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. And we're going to take a little break and talk to you on the other side.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Said we'd be back. We're back. And by the way, you check us out, taylor-report.com. We're going to be talking soon with Steve Gowans and he has a column, What's Left. You do Steve Gowans, and you'll find him on the Internet. But I know he's at gowans.wordpress.com. He is a very savvy commentator, and he looks with, you say gimlet or gimlet-eyed?
Gim.
You're going to go with Gimlet.
Yeah, I'll go with Gimlet.
And, yeah, he's kind of hard to fool. And he doesn't join the type of people who are terribly enthusiastic about Lester Pearson, et cetera. He's done a lot of tremendous writing. And we have an episode now that we need to talk to him about. And I think we're joined by Stephen Gowans. You there, Stephen?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
How you doing?
Good, good.
Stephen, we just had this dramatic show at the United Nations where, if I can capture the Toronto Star headline, was Russia blocks United Nations action or something. And I thought they're kind of getting us off on the wrong foot there, right? The United Nations is discussing something, and its leadership doesn't come to an agreement, and the motion dies. The UN hasn't been prevented from being the United Nations. That's what the United Nations does. And what does this episode tell you, this latest show where the U.S. ambassador walked out and said she was disgusted and she was outraged and all that?
Well, I mean, there are quite a number of instances in which the United States exercises its veto at the U.N. Security Council, and this is often reported in the back of newspapers. And I can't recall anyone walking out in disgust, although it may happen.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, the United States has its own interests, and Russia has its interests, and China has its interests, and China and Russia vetoed the resolution. But I think that the reasons that the Russian foreign minister put forth for vetoing the resolution were sound. I mean, he pointed out that if the resolution were adopted, it would be tantamount to the international community intervening on one side in a civil war, which I think it surely would have been.
Yeah. By the way, when the U.S. had a civil war, they threatened to go to war with anybody who interfered with their civil war. By the way, Syria, taking your point, Syria is one of those countries which they're not like Libya, but they do have difficulties in being able to actually stand up for their own sovereignty, right? I mean, because they've been awfully polite when the Arab League, run by monarchs, says them they want to come and see if they're democratic, and they say, oh, okay. It's awfully hard to survive in a world where you faced with people like the Arab League, the Gulf Council states, and Britain, the United States, and France.
Yeah, it's difficult to survive in the world when many countries and many people want your government to collapse. Mm-hmm. It's certainly the case that the United States and its Western allies want to see the overthrow of the Assad government. In fact, it's not widely reported, but the Bush administration had called the Assad government a member of the junior varsity axis of evil, along with Libya and Cuba, and suggested at the time that Syria should become the next target for Washington's regime change agenda. Of course, it didn't. However, at the time, the Bush administration did arrange for money to be funneled to the Syrian opposition, and this we know from a WikiLeaks cable. And it's kind of curious, or it's interesting. Occasionally, newspapers will tell you that the Assad government says, well, the reason for the uprising is this is driven by militant Islamists with foreign backing. And then, you know, they're laughed at and it's all dismissed. And they talk to Hillary Clinton, who has apparently a more realistic view. But, I mean, if you start examining the Assad government's explanation for what's going on and testing it, see if it's sound, what you discover is that it is. I mean, they talk about militant Islamists. Well, you know, there's been a series of Islamist uprisings from 1964 against mm-hmm. what Islamists regard as an atheist or apostate regime, which is the Ba'athist government. The Ba'athist government, or the Ba'ath Party, is originally pan-Arabic, non-Marxist socialist, non-sectarian, or secular. And that kind of socialist orientation, secular orientation, got under the skin of the Sunni majority, because, I mean, Syria is comprised of a majority of Sunni Arabs.
Yes.
Of the Alawites, who are a minority, the Christians, Kurds.
Yes.
But the Sunni Islamists have, for years and years, decades, been opposed to this kind of Ba'athist, non-sectarian, non-religious, secular regime. So there's that, and then there's this foreign backing. So you can dismiss that, say, oh, that's funny, you know, foreign backing, that's mm-hmm. unlikely. But the WikiLeaks cable revealed that the U.S. money for the Syrian opposition began flowing under George Bush, as I said. Mm-hmm. Around the same time, Syrian exiles in Europe founded the Movement for Justice and Development, which openly advocates for Assad's removal. The leader of the Movement for Justice and Development is a principal member of the key exile opposition movement, the Syrian National Council. And, I mean, so here you have confirmation of what the Ba'athist government is arguing, which is that it's militant Islamists with foreign backing.
Yeah. Now, by the way, Stephen, I mean, it's tempting, isn't it, to say that Mr. Harper might be a closet Islamist? He seems enthusiastic about people who, by the way, are quite bigoted. I read sometimes all the websites, but there's a very smart University of California professor who calls himself the Angry Arab. And he shares with us some of the broadcasts of the oppositionists. And one of the leading ones is a cleric who, by the way, is based in Saudi Arabia. He is talking about annihilating the Alawi.
Mm-hmm.
And he's part of this glorified opposition to Assad, which is, you know, on the face, they tell us, democratic. But in reality, he is one of the worst examples of a bigot, and someone who's advocating a genocidal policy. And he's not a small guy. He has his own TV show in Saudi Arabia. That's a pretty good show. Probably has more listeners and viewers than we do. And here's Harper saying, oh, no, these guys are fine fellas. I mean, what are we supposed to make of that?
Yes, well, I mean, much that spills from Harper's mouth is not worth listening to, or certainly not worth believing, especially his latest justification for the aggression against Iran being that Iran frightens him.
Yeah. By the way, I thought he maybe made a tactical error. He's never supposed to be afraid. You're supposed to take all your cues from Clint Eastwood. You know, nothing scares you. If you say you're afraid of Iran, I mean, all those guys in Alberta are going to quit on you. So one wonders about his choice of words. I got to ask you, but how disappointing is it? And could you explain why we have someone like Harper who's saying he came in right after the UN vote and he said, well, that cuts it. You know, we obviously have to do something about these guys in Syria. And he's talking about policies to hurt them. It turns out there's a poodle in his house called the NDP who is apparently housebroken because they said, well, they would help out by saying that we should pull the ambassador out of Syria. We're pretty much weaponless, aren't we? We're going to politically. That's an amazing situation. The Social Democratic Party, that's all they can offer?
Yeah. I guess amazing, astonishing. Disappointing. Maybe not so much astonishing or amazing. But, I think there's a lot of confusion about Syria. I mean, little is known about it except what's read in newspapers, and that's superficial at best and unquestionably politically tainted. And then there's, you know, the matter of intimidation, is that many people don't want to actively oppose intervention in Syria or sanctions against Syria for fear of being smeared as, you know, to mimic the language that's used, supporters of an authoritarian regime that's killing its people and violently suppressing a peaceful uprising for democracy, which isn't what's happening, you know, but the right has been effective at establishing this as the dominant narrative, and I think a lot of people and groups don't want to challenge that or believe that they're not going to be able to challenge it.
Yeah, we just spoke to Eve Engler, and one of the things that came through, he's got a new book about the Lester Pearson's personal story. And what comes through there is, I mean, Canada was a major part of, and every major political party in the Western world built this thing called NATO. And NATO kind of defines what an issue is. And everybody just sort of adjusts to that. There's nobody saying anymore, I thought that NATO was supposed to go with the end of the Soviet Union. How come it's getting bigger? Is that a correct? I mean, that we. When I listen to NDP do say what they've said, I just say to myself, they're NATO social democrats.
Yes.
And the first thing in their lives is, you know, what does NATO want? And then I'll adjust my social democracy to suit it.
Yeah, I mean, on most foreign policy issues, I don't think the NDP is going to challenge the current government or NATO. In fact, it's hard to think of any in which they would challenge the dominant perspective.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Steve Gowans, and it's gowans.wordpress.com. In terms of the role of media and setting the agenda, it would take a lion-hearted person, practically, in contemporary politics to bite back. But for example, and one of the things you focus on is the role of so-called NGOs. And recently on the CBC, I heard an NGO. And they've been favored by two interviews in a matter of 3 weeks to explain Syria. And the name of the NGO is one I think you might recognize. It's called the Henry Jackson Institute. Uh-huh. And based on the man Scoop Jackson, the liberal imperialist. Now, if you go to them, I mean, they say blatantly that it has to be – they're in favor of capitalism. They're in favor of a leading role. They want – Britain to resume its leading role as a kind of cutting edge. And if that's the person you ask about Syria, you're going to get a war, right?
Yeah. And another interesting NGO is the, you've probably heard of this one, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Tell us about them. Who are, where are they based, and what are their good works?
Well, I kept stumbling upon them in newspaper articles. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights is telling us about all of the...
They keep track of all the bodies. They know how many people were killed, for example, this morning, right?
Right. So I wondered, well, who are these people? I've never heard of them before, so it shouldn't be difficult to find out who they are. I'd simply do a Google search, and if you do a Google search and you land on their website, you'll discover that, I mean, they're hardly a neutral human rights observatory. What they are is a group that is committed openly to the overthrow of the Syrian government. So, and yet they're quoted and cited often in major newspapers. Mm-hmm. Always without acknowledging that perhaps they have a political agenda. Not perhaps, they definitely do have a political agenda. I mean, it's almost like, you know, the CBC was doing coverage of an election and using Stephen Harper's mother as one of its main analysts.
Don't give them ideas. yes, the NGOs... We have, of course, there's also another famous one, and you've commented on this program about him, the guy in Boston, who we now that we're all doing revisiting the Arab Spring, he was nominated as the leader of it. They said he was just a wonderful man who had these great ideas, and somehow the Arabs found out about them, and now they're having all these wonderful revolutions. I'm sorry, I forget his name. Could you tell us about him a bit?
Yeah, he's he's a principal exponent of the idea of the use of nonviolent direct action to challenge what is called authoritarian regimes, but usually ends up being governments that the United States would like to see overthrown. And he's not a pacifist. He's someone who believes that nonviolent resistance is more effective than conventional warfare or guerrilla warfare or an armed rebellion. And he's been involved as an advisor, either directly or indirectly, to various groups that have been seeking to overthrow governments.
He's the Einstein Institute.
Yes.
Yes. Poor Einstein. I mean, there's a – you wish there would be a copyright fight. and now another organization that's playing a role and actually has been called out by some people is Amnesty has recently seemed to have joined the side saying overthrow Assad, right?
Mm-hmm.
They issued some kind of statement of, rebuking Russia for not signing on to an interventionist operation.
Yes, and Amnesty International is often involved in legitimizing kind of foreign interventions, legitimizing what are really illegitimate interventions in other countries' affairs. I mean, they've done it on a number of occasions, stretching all the way back to the first Gulf War, when they were instrumental in giving credence to that, you know, the fiction about the Iraqi army taking Kuwaiti babies out of incubators and smashing them on the ground.
That was, and they sail on and they get their funding and everybody pats them on the back, and movie stars say, "Thank goodness I'm in Amnesty. I must be a nice person." Amazing.
Yes, one of the most, for me, irritating things they've done recently is they wrote a long report condemning the North Korean government for its poor health care, not once mentioning that North Korea has been the most sanctioned country in the world, I mean, for decades. And those sanctions,
yes,
certainly had a profound influence on their ability to provide health care.
Yeah, and by the way, has a better standard of living than Afghanistan, where the American Army's been standing around now for as long as I can remember. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans. It's gowans.wordpress.com. I want to ask you if you were surprised, I thought the United States had decided after Madeleine Albright first uttered these famous words to not repeat them. She once called America the one indispensable nation in the world. And lo and behold, President Obama, in his State of the Union speech, repeated that exact phrase. Now, how does Canada, Norway, or South Korea say, oh, yeah, right, amen to that? The one indispensable nation.
Which I guess that every other nation is dispensable.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of remarkable hubris, isn't it, at this point? It tends to bear out your writings. I mean, here's they think they own the place.
Mm-hmm. They certainly like to, yes.
And, Stephen, I have to ask you, there's a kind of a thesis on the left, and I know that you write a great column that's titled What's the Left, What's Left, but... And it is that, well, the U.S. is a declining power. And they like to say that. It's all over. It's finished. It's, you know, washed up. If it is, how come they have bases everywhere and they still get their way? What's your take on this? Is it a declining power?
Well, it's certainly not a declining military power. And they certainly exercise hegemony almost worldwide. I mean, there are very few countries anymore that are not under U.S. domination or influence. And so I think it would be a gross exaggeration to say that it's a waning power.
With NATO expanding, I mean, Turkey now is taking some kind of missile operation on their soil. Poland wants to, or some do, and NATO is still interviewing people who want to be NATO.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems to me that people who sort of like to whistle and say, oh, well, they're finished, and I don't know where they get that. I mean, they ought to be kind of cautious about that sort of assessment.
No, I mean, there's absolutely no evidence of that. I mean, perhaps its economic power relative to other countries has diminished from what it was after the Second World War, but certainly its military power is undiminished and is growing. But speaking about NATO, I was fascinated by, just recently there was a report about how it is that the United States is going to withdraw some troops from Europe. And it's always interesting to look at U.S. troop deployment in Europe and then scratch your head about why there are so many of them.
Yes.
54,000 U.S. troops in Germany, for example, and thousands, tens of thousands in Italy and Spain and the U.K., and interestingly, the news report said, well, they're there because of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
I mean, that was 20 years ago. Why
yeah. Could we ask the tombstone his opinion? No, this is really, in terms of salesmanship, you have to give it to him.
Mm-hmm.
We're not even, it's considered impolite, right? It's like mentioning Israel's bombs. It's kind of this enforced silence, a kind of a look. Don't mention it. So if you say, why are you still in Germany? Why are you still in Korea? And why does Israel have 300 bombs? Those are, I don't hear those things when I circulate around. People feel they shouldn't talk about that.
And I seem to recall many years that Alexander Haig was once asked, why is it that there are so many U.S. troops remaining in Europe? And his answer was that was, I think to use his words, the guarantor of our access to their market.
There's a candid man. Stephen, it's great talking to you. Thank you for all the enlightenment. Thanks for the great columns. And we hope we can talk to you again soon.
Well, thank you for having me. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. That's Stephen Gowans. Gowans.wordpress.com. And... good title of his one of his site is What's Left, and beats me. Bets Attune on at 612 Barkham Street, Tuesday, February the 14th, 7 o'clock. Haroon Siddiqui is going to talk about the Arab Spring, and that should be interesting. That's the 14th. It's Bets Attune always has very interesting programs. It's a $5 minimum entry. And Phil, you made it to the program. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
You watch the Super Bowl?
I did not. I made it a principal thing not to watch the Super Bowl.
Did you watch Madonna?
I didn't watch Madonna. I'm just so counterculture these days, Phil. I just
well, we congratulate you. You are. That's like drinking water instead of bad alcohol.
That's it.
Good for you. Listen, there was a halftime remark that I wanted to make sure I passed on. There's an ad done by Clint Eastwood. He's for General Motors, I think it is. And it's tough Clint walking around the streets of America, and he says it's halftime in America, and like it's halftime in the game, you see, and we're going to come back stronger in the second half. And I have to say, I'm very curious about it, because you want to remind everybody he's an actor. He was mayor of Carmel, which is not tough duty. And also, his voice sounds like it's the fourth quarter. And so I would warn people, you know, be careful which actor you choose. I have something for Black History Month I want to make sure I share as soon as I remember which page I put this on. We had a great mayor, as everyone knows, in Toronto. This was many years ago. His name was William Lyon Mackenzie. And he was, of course, also rather famous because he was involved in a rebellion. And in the rebellion in 1837, the battle was for responsible government.
Responsible government, the right of the people here to govern themselves, which was subversive.
And the British were not terribly enthusiastic about that. Mm-hmm. And people, you know, kind of have a hard time getting a handle on how to look at Mackenzie. And, you know, while he's man from long ago, they don't have an idea of who he was like. And I can tell you, share two things. We often talk about libraries on this program. He was a big champion of public libraries, and he pointed out the places in the world, in the British colonies, where they went to the trouble to make sure the people had libraries, and that was good for him. I mean, and I was glad to read it. I have here now in front of me, and apropos of Black History Month, an article published in his paper, and this is written by our first mayor, William Lyon Mackenzie. It's called Slaughter of Negroes at Niagara. We have been informed that the town of Niagara was much disturbed on Friday last in consequence of an order having arrived there from His Excellency, the Lieutenant Governor, to the sheriff to give up a colored man of the name of Mosby to the authorities from the state of Kentucky, who, it is said, effected his escape from thence in April last, and as they could not claim him as a slave, they processed an order from the authorities of that state to Sir Francis Head to surrender him as a horse thief. So here's a slave who escaped, and they knew they couldn't say, we want the slave back, so they said, he stole the horse belonging to his master. So our lieutenant governor said, oh, well, that's different. He's a horse thief. He continues, the deputy sheriff, accompanied by a number of constables and soldiers, proceeded to carry the peremptory orders of His Excellency into effect and to deliver the unfortunate man to the authorities when a numerous body of colored people appeared, apparently to prevent the execution of the order. As soon as Mosby was taken outside the jail gate, we are informed, he disengaged himself from his irons and, jumping from the wagon in which he was placed, escaped when the deputy sheriff ordered the soldiers and constables to fire. And the result was that two colored men were shot dead. And this is Niagara Falls. And several wounded. And that's the Constitution of 20 September 1837. And there's more on this. He says, Mosby's master sought him here, applied to a kindred spirit in Lieutenant Governor Head, for authority to take him back. The benevolent people of Niagara prayed that he might not be sent back, to meet, no doubt, a terrible fate as an escape, as an example to others, the sons of African misery. Sir Francis received both applications, ordered the slave back to Kentucky. The Niagara sheriff got the inhuman order, did his utmost to fulfill it. The citizens would not assist him. They were horror-struck. Now, here's the detail I want to make sure I pass on. The two men killed while helping Mosby to escape were Herbert Holmes and Jacob Green. And that's in the paper published by William Lyon Mackenzie, first mayor of Toronto, and he was talking about the heroic escape. What I'm suggesting for Black History Month is that we get people to set up a monument to Herbert Holmes, lost his life, and Jacob Green lost his life helping an escaped slave escape from being returned to Kentucky to a slave master by the Lieutenant Governor General of Canada. Anyway, so this has been the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM, and we'll see you.